Welcome to the Age of Napoleon. Dispatch number 2. Before we get started, I'd like to thank everyone for all your kind wishes. I have recovered from my COVID. I'm feeling a lot better. My advice is, don't get COVID if you can avoid it. It is not pleasant, and as you could probably hear in the last episode, it really took a lot out of me. Anyway. For once, I don't have to give the reminder to sign up for the Patreon. If you're listening to this, thank you for your support. I was planning on starting these off with material cut from the previous episode, but we're in unusual circumstances this time. As you probably remember, last episode was short, so obviously I wound up cutting a ton of stuff, but I plan on using all or most of it for the next episode, so I don't really have anything for this dispatch. So let's dive right into the listener questions. We got a lot of good ones. Thank you to everyone who contributed. If I didn't get to yours, sorry, but I may use it for the next one. Justin Beslady asked, Cambaceres may be the first queer person discussed in detail during the course of this show. Despite being gay, and that fact being common knowledge, Napoleon seemed to trust him and his abilities. Do we have any understanding of Napoleon's opinions on the LGBT community? He seems to have only cared about merit, but perhaps he harbored private opinions one way or the other. First of all, it's worth mentioning that Cambaceres is not the first non-straight person we've discussed on this show. Statistically speaking, we've probably talked about dozens of people from this era who experienced some kind of attraction to members of the same sex, but either never acted on them or only did so in secret due to the prevailing attitudes of the time. However, there is a person we've discussed in great detail whose attraction to members of the same sex is quite well documented and accepted by most modern historians, King Frederick the Great of Prussia. Frederick's case is interesting because his inclination towards men was well known during and immediately after his lifetime. Not by the common people, of course, but among the literate classes, it was practically an open secret. In the 1780s, there was even a pamphlet called The Private Life of the King of Prussia that laid out the sexual politics of Frederick's court with surprising frankness. Unsurprisingly, this pamphlet was banned, in large part due to Frederick's efforts, but it circulated widely. However, attitudes changed over the course of the 19th century, and this side of Frederick's personality was practically written out of history. The king's total lack of romantic relationships or even friendships with women was chalked up to some kind of psychological aversion to sex. Apparently, people of this era preferred to think of him as some kind of extreme neurotic, rather than consider the possibility that he might have preferred the company of men. This side of Frederick's story was rediscovered in the 20th century. Attitudes towards homosexuality began to change again, and the academic study of history became more rigorous, and all the obvious clues about Frederick's sexuality became impossible to ignore. Anyway, back to your question. We should be careful in talking about this topic, because it cuts to the cores of people's identities, so we need to be sensitive and avoid causing offense, but also because we need to avoid anachronism. Today, sexual orientation is mostly viewed as a part of a person's identity. General consensus is that these traits are largely innate, and that people who share them are all part of a wider community with a shared subculture and a shared political interest in securing certain civil rights. But this is a very modern way of thinking. It was not the view in Napoleon's time. Same-sex, romantic, and sexual relationships were generally seen as a form of vice. Imagine how people today might look at someone with a severe drug or alcohol problem, or a crippling gambling addiction, or a person who compulsively has sex with strangers. Some people might look at them with pity and sympathy. Some might blame society or chalk it up to mental illness. Others would hold them in contempt, or even look at them with hatred. You might find a few people who would say, hey, someone's personal life is none of my business, or what's the harm in indulging oneself as long as no one gets hurt? But the overwhelming consensus is that these types of behaviors are not normal or healthy. This is basically how people in Napoleon's day viewed homosexuality. It was not seen as an identity, but a form of temptation that people could be drawn into. Those who actually experienced these feelings probably had a different view, but there was such a taboo against writing or even speaking about such matters that they had no real way of changing people's minds. As for Napoleon's personal views, by modern standards, we would probably consider him homophobic. I can think of several occasions where he expressed contempt for men he saw as effeminate. He was a strong believer in traditional gender roles. He believed men should aspire to be as masculine as possible, and women should aspire to be as feminine as possible. Of course, masculinity and femininity are not fixed concepts, and were quite a bit different in Napoleon's time than they are today. But that's a matter for another episode. Suffice it to say, Napoleon's ideas about gender did not include same-sex relations. We also do know of one occasion in which he teased Cambaceres for his sexuality. During a meeting of the Council of State, Cambaceres suggested sending a woman on a sensitive diplomatic mission, which would have been unusual but not totally unprecedented. Napoleon responded, quote, "So, now you prefer women?" End quote. Not very funny, but relatively benign. On the other hand, Napoleon doesn't seem to have been particularly bothered by homosexuality. By the standards of his own time, he was relatively open-minded on the issue. He did not believe sodomy should be a crime, and resisted efforts to insert anti-sodomy legislation into his legal codes. From his correspondence, we know that this was a matter of principle for him. He did not believe the state should regulate sexual activity between consenting adults. Napoleon may have teased Cambaceres about his sexuality, but he was fond of teasing all his associates. He made fun of Joachim Murat's outrageous clothing. He made fun of Junot's drinking and womanizing. He made fun of Augereau's crude manners. This was not unusual behavior for Napoleon. As you say in your question, when it came to judging other people, he was always more concerned with merit than their personal characteristics. So to sum up, Napoleon's views on homosexuality were certainly not perfect by modern standards, but he doesn't seem to have harbored any particular malice towards those who preferred the company of the same sex. To Napoleon, this was more of a personal foible than a grave sin. Next question, Nathaniel Webb asked, "Your discussion in episode 92 of all the crowns Napoleon handed out to his family reminded me of something I've always wondered. Is there a reason Lucien, my favorite Bonaparte sibling, didn't get anything? Is it true he and Napoleon had a falling out over their ideals?" This one I can answer relatively quickly. Napoleon did not give Lucien a crown in 1806 because in 1806 he and Lucien were not on speaking terms. In fact, Lucien was not even living in France. Part of the point of giving these crowns to members of the Bonaparte family was that Napoleon believed his siblings would be loyal and pliant. But due to their personal dispute, Napoleon didn't think Lucien would toe the line, and so he did not get a crown. As you mentioned, the conflict between Napoleon and Lucien is often explained as a conflict about ideals. The romantic, idealistic, republican Lucien versus the hard-nosed, cynical Napoleon, who wanted to make himself emperor. That was certainly one element of their falling out, but family relationships are complicated, and the more you look at their dispute, the less clear it seems. Lucien also felt like he'd been shut out of power in the aftermath of Napoleon's coup, and that his brother should have done more to advocate for him. Personally, I think the unusual circumstances of the coup of Brumaire cast a pall over the brothers' relationship. You might remember that at a key moment of the coup, Napoleon seemed to be faltering, and Lucien was the one who stepped in, took charge, and ensured a successful outcome. I think that really bothered Napoleon. He was the elder brother. He was the man of action. But at the decisive moment, he hesitated. I think it disturbed him that he had to be saved by his little brother, the big-talking politician who had never been anywhere near a battlefield. As we discussed in our past episodes, in some ways, Napoleon had been more of a father to Lucien than an older brother. During the Brumaire coup, this boy who Napoleon had raised saw him at perhaps the weakest moment of his life, and recognized it for what it was. I think that poisoned their relationship. Napoleon could not bear the fact that his little brother had seen his weakness. and this made the other differences between them rise to the surface, resulting in a split. However, this is not the end of their story. We will see Lucien again. By the way, he is also my favorite of the Bonaparte siblings. Next question, Tim Lyons asked, how were the regimes of the consulate and the empire seen in the United States? What were the diplomatic relations like? I don't want to go too far into detail on this one, because I plan on covering the United States and the Napoleonic Wars in the main episodes, although I haven't yet decided when or how. But I thought I'd give you a few general thoughts, particularly about how Napoleon himself was viewed by Americans. One interesting thing to keep in mind about America at this time was that it was a revolutionary state. The War of Independence was only 23 years in the past. The Constitution was only 18 years old. Almost all of America's political leadership had participated in the events of the Revolution, either as politicians or military officers. The ideology of the Revolution was still strong. Many Americans were proud to be from what they saw as the only truly free country in the world. American journalists, writers, and politicians loved nothing more than to denounce tyranny and expound on the virtues of free republicanism. Obviously, this kind of talk always came with a heavy dose of hypocrisy, but among the people whose opinions really mattered in early 19th century America, it was generally believed. And so, there was a great deal of skepticism and even fear of Napoleon in America. His coronation was widely seen as a betrayal of the Republican ideals, which were held dear by so many Americans. Not only had Bonaparte become a monarch, which many Americans saw as synonymous with tyrant, he had done so in a grand, opulent ceremony. There was a strong puritanical streak in early America that distrusted anything ostentatious. For many, the splendor of the coronation was proof that Napoleon had sold out and was indulging in his worst instincts. Perhaps ironically, from a modern perspective, many early Americans also harbored a deep distrust of professional military officers and standing armies. And Napoleon was nothing if not the embodiment of the modern professional officer, a product of Europe's most powerful standing army. That, too, was reason for skepticism. And, of course, there were geopolitical reasons for Americans to be suspicious of Napoleon. During our episodes on Haiti, we discussed Napoleon's ambitions to restore France's colonial empire in the New World. Louisiana was a major linchpin of those ambitions, particularly the city of New Orleans. As the port at the end of the Mississippi River, New Orleans was perhaps the most important strategic and commercial location in all of North America. The French wanted it, the British wanted it, and the Americans wanted it. Whoever controlled New Orleans would be in a good position to dictate the destiny of the entire continent. The United States considered securing New Orleans a vital national interest. The idea of Louisiana and this important port coming under the control of an ambitious and capable European ruler like Napoleon was deeply disturbing. Of course, the calculations changed when Napoleon sold Louisiana to the USA in 1803, but there was still a lingering, if not entirely rational, fear that this ambitious man would someday turn his eyes towards the young American Republic. With all that said, there were people in every country who admired Napoleon. The USA was no exception. For one thing, he was a staunch enemy of Britain. There was a lot of anti-British sentiment in America. Not only were there the old hatreds from the War of Independence, the post-revolutionary era had seen intense commercial and geopolitical rivalry with Britain. These feelings were not universal. There were a lot of places in America where people were willing to bury the hatchet and wanted to do business with the British. But there were many Americans who felt that anyone who was an enemy of Britain was a friend of the American people, and indeed, a friend of all humanity. There were also some who saw Napoleon as a classic American type, the self-made man. After all, the emperor had risen largely on his own merits, not by the chance of birth. Like many of the American elite, he was born into the lower ranks of the gentry, into a family that was locally prominent, but poor by the standards of the great noble houses of Europe. He came from Corsica, a place that was considered a rustic, uncivilized backwater by the enlightened intellectuals in places like London and Paris, just like America. And so, many Americans saw themselves in Bonaparte. Interestingly, some reactionary European critics of Napoleon have also noticed this similarity, but they see it as an indictment of his character rather than something to be celebrated. That this so-called emperor was little better than a vulgar backwoods American. Lastly, Napoleon himself was a great admirer of George Washington. Washington died in December of 1799, only a few weeks after the coup of Brumaire brought Napoleon to power. When the news reached France, the First Consul announced a day of public mourning, the only European ruler to do so. He personally wrote and published a tribute to America's first president. Quote, "His cause was the cause of humanity," end quote. I don't want to go too far down this rabbit hole. Like I said, we'll be tackling this topic in the main narrative at some point in the future, but hopefully that whets your appetite. Next question, Jack Michaels asked, "In early episodes, you gave some great introductions to the backgrounds of some of Napoleon's marshals. As a huge fan of the lives and rivalries of his marshals, have you ever thought about revisiting and going over more marshals? I know the fast rise of the Third Coalition added a bunch, and it's probably hard to do it once." I had a couple similar questions to this one, and I've seen other comments on these lines from listeners in the past. I also love the marshals. Not only are they great characters in their own right, I think reading through their biographies gives you some interesting insights into the internal dynamics of the French army. I've thought about doing biography episodes on them, but here's the problem. Napoleon granted the title of marshal to 26 men. If I covered one marshal per episode starting this month, I would finish in October of 2024. If I did two per episode, it would still take over a year. We've taken digressions before, but I think stalling the narrative for that long would totally kill our momentum, and maybe even ruin the show. Maybe I'll find some other way to cover them, but devoting entire episodes to the marshals does not seem feasible. Next, Raptor asked, "When talking about the French army of this time, the marshals are often singled out when talking about the French leadership. Who were some of the most notable French generals who didn't receive the distinction of marshal?" This is almost too good a question because I could go on this topic for quite some time. There were so many interesting and amusing characters among the French generals of this era. So I'll just pick the first few that come to mind. One person I've always found interesting is General Charles Edward Jennings de Kilmaine, who we introduced in our episodes on the First Italian Campaign. Obviously, the fact that an Irishman became a leading general in the army of the French Republic is inherently interesting, but that's far from the only notable thing about him. Kilmaine was a very competent commander. Napoleon held him in high esteem, and his nickname within the army was Brave Kilmaine. As one of the divisional commanders during the First Italian Campaign, he played a big role in some of the most significant events of the war. He also played politics among the exiled Irish revolutionaries in Paris, and probably would have had a big role in the French invasion of Ireland if it had actually been carried out. Some of his closest friends included the great Anglo-American radical Thomas Paine and the famous Irish revolutionary Wolfe Tone. After the failure of the expedition to Ireland, Kilmaine became the commander of French troops in Switzerland, before he was forced to resign due to poor health. If he had stayed healthy, it would have been Kilmaine, not Andre Massena, who faced off against the great Russian general Alexander Suvorov at the beginning of the War of the Second Coalition, in what ultimately became one of the most memorable campaigns of that war. Whatever illness forced Kilmaine to leave Switzerland would ultimately kill him. He died at the age of just 48, which might be why he isn't better remembered, and is definitely why he didn't make marshal. I've also always been interested in another revolutionary general associated with the Ireland expedition, Lazar Hoche. I've talked about Hoche in great detail in the past, so I won't go through his biography again, but I figured he merits a mention. There's also General Antoine de La Salle, who I mentioned briefly in our episodes on Egypt, and again in our recent episode on the cavalry. La Salle was that famous light cavalry general who said that any hussar who wasn't dead by 30 was a blackguard. La Salle was maybe the most flamboyant character of all the French generals, which is really saying something. He is endlessly quotable. On one occasion, when he was reassigned from Spain to Germany, a friend asked La Salle if he would travel via Paris, to which he replied, quote, "Yes, it is the shortest way. I shall arrive at 5 in the morning, I shall order a pair of boots, I shall make my wife pregnant, and I shall depart," end quote. Upon arriving in Germany, La Salle found the army preparing for battle at Wagram. He opened his luggage and discovered that his pipe, a bottle of liquor, and a drinking glass had all broken in transit. La Salle took this as a sign that he would be killed in the coming battle, and wrote one last letter to his wife, which included a very famous line, quote, "My heart belongs to you, my blood to the emperor, my life to honor," end quote. He was right, he would die at Wagram. His last recorded words were, quote, "The battle is almost finished, and we are the only ones who have not contributed to the victory. Let's go, follow me," end quote. He was 34 years old, but I don't think anyone would call him a blackguard. There are a few generals we've talked about on the show who you might think made marshal, but did not. Louis Desaix almost certainly would have, but he died in 1800, before the marshalate was restored. General Jean-Andoche Junot was one of Napoleon's oldest and most loyal companions, but he never got the honor either. As we've discussed, he declined with age, becoming increasingly unreliable and erratic, probably at least in part due to a severe head wound he received in Italy. There's also two men we introduced at the same time in episode 84 on the Battle of Austerlitz, Generals Dominique Vandamme and Louis-Vincent Joseph Leblanc de Saint-Hilaire, who commanded the two divisions that Marshal Soult led up the Pratzen Heights, ensuring the French victory. Although they served together, these two men could not have been more different. Vandamme was a great soldier, but a nasty character. On campaign, he was notorious for looting, stealing, and brutal treatment of civilians, and even his own men. Napoleon once said to him, quote, "If I had two of you, the only solution would be to have one hang the other," end quote. In person, Vandamme was notorious for his negative attitude and acid tongue. He was constantly criticizing everyone, and was not polite about it. He wasn't even afraid to lay into Napoleon himself when the mood struck. In short, nobody liked Vandamme, and they probably were a little scared of him. His only real redeeming quality was that he was a great general. But between his reputation for brutality and his frankly horrible personality, he was never made marshal. His colleague, General Saint-Hilaire, was the polar opposite, liked by everyone, and famous within the army for his quick wit and congenial personality. Every superior officer he ever had praised his energy, strategic thinking, and bravery. He had a very good record as a divisional commander, and Napoleon thought very highly of him. The general consensus among historians is that Saint-Hilaire was on the verge of winning a marshal's baton when he was badly wounded at the Battle of Aspern-Essling in 1809, dying 2 weeks later. There are also a few generals I'm always happy to see pop up in my research for totally arbitrary reasons. One of these is the great cuirassier general, Jean-Joseph d'Hautpoul. I like him simply because he's the only major figure from the Grande Armée who was as tall as me, and big guys gotta stick together. Another example is General Marcellin Marbeau. Marbeau wrote a very famous memoir that I've always enjoyed. He came from a military family. His father, Jean-Antoine Marbeau, was also a general, who fought in the wars of the First and Second Coalitions and died during the Siege of Genoa. His older brother, Adolphe Marbeau, was also a general. So every time I see the Marbeaus pop up in my research, I feel a little spark of recognition, almost like I know them personally from reading Marcellin's writing. I'd like to close out today with a reading from Marbeau's memoirs. This passage took place during the Siege of Genoa in 1800, shortly after the death of Marcellin's father. He was 17 years old and serving on the headquarters staff of General Andre Massena, learning the trade. Quote, "Of my own perils during the siege, I will confine myself to recounting the two principal. I have already said that the Austrians and British took it in turn to keep us constantly on the alert. The former attacked us at daybreak on the land side, fought us all day, and returned to rest at night. During the night, Lord Keith's fleet came and bombarded us, trying, under cover of darkness, to get possession of the port, and thus forcing the garrison to watch that side most carefully, and preventing them from getting the least rest. One night, when the bombardment was more violent than usual, Massena was informed that with the help of some flares which had been fired on the beach, many English vessels laden with troops could be seen advancing towards the breakwater. Massena mounted with all his regular staff and his escort of guides. We were some 150 to 200 horsemen. As we passed a little square called the Campetto, the commander-in-chief halted to speak to an officer who was returning from the port. Everyone was thronging around him when a cry was heard, 'Look out, a shell!' We all looked up and beheld a vast mass of red-hot iron descending on the group of men and horses who were packed into the narrow space. I happened to be close to the wall of a great house, above the door of which was a marble balcony. I urged my horse under this, and several of my neighbors did the same. The shell dropped precisely on this balcony. It smashed to pieces, bounded off on the pavement, and burst with a tremendous noise in the middle of the square, which for a moment was lit up by the flash, then relapsed into deeper darkness. We thought the loss must have been great. The profound silence was broken by General Massena asking if anyone was wounded. There was no answer, for by a really miraculous chance, not one of the fragments of the shell had struck a man or horse in the crowd. As for those who, like myself, were under the balcony, we were covered with dust and fragments of building materials, but no one was wounded. I have said that as a rule, the English only bombarded us at night, but one day, when they were celebrating some festival or other, their fleet, dressed with flags, sailed up to the town in the middle of the day and amused itself by showering projectiles on us. The one of our batteries which was in the best position for replying to this fire was near the breakwater, on a great tower-like bastion called the Lantern. The commander-in-chief ordered me to carry to the officer in charge of this battery instructions, to take good aim before firing, and to let his fire converge on an English brig, which had impudently anchored a short distance from the Lantern. Our gunners aimed so well that one of our 500-pound shells dropped on the English brig, smashing through from deck to keel and sinking it instantly. This enraged the English admiral so much that he ordered all his gunboats to advance upon the Lantern, upon which they opened a furious fire. Having fulfilled my orders, my duty was to return to Massena, but as is often and rightly said, young soldiers, not realizing danger, frequently face it more coolly than experienced veterans. The spectacle which I witnessed was highly interesting. The platform of the Lantern, paved with flagstones, was about the area of an average courtyard, and was armed with 12 pieces of artillery, the carriages of which were of great size. Difficult as it is for a vessel at sea to throw shells with accuracy at so small a mark as the platform of a tower, the English contrived to drop several on the Lantern. At the moments when they fell, the gunners took refuge behind and beneath the massive wooden carriages. I followed their example, but our refuge was by no means secure, since the shells, being unable to break through the floor of the platform, rolled along the flagstones, without our being able to foresee what direction they would take, and their fragments, spinning from every point on the platform, flew beneath and behind the gun carriages. It was, therefore, absurd for anyone to stay there who, like me, was not obliged to do so. But I felt a fearful joy, if I may use that term, in rushing to cover with the gunners every time a shell fell, and in returning with them as soon as it had burst and the fragments no longer flew. It was a sport for which I might have paid dearly. One gunner had his legs broken, others were severely wounded, for the huge fragments of iron did frightful execution. One of them cut in two a great timber from one of the carriages, behind which I was just going to take shelter. In spite of this, I stayed on the platform until Colonel Mouton, in later days a marshal and Count of Lobau, who had served under my father and took an interest in me, happened to pass near the lantern, and ordered me peremptorily to come away and go back to my post with the commander-in-chief. He added, "You are still a young fellow, but you must learn that in war it is foolish to expose oneself to needless dangers. What good would it have done you if you had a leg smashed without any advantage to your country?" I never forgot this lesson, and long after thanked the Count of Lobau for it. It has often struck me what a difference there would have been in my fortunes if I had lost a leg at the age of 17. End quote. I think we'll leave things there for now. I hope you enjoyed this, and thank you again for your support. Lastly, please don't forget to leave questions for the next dispatch in the comments of this episode. And, as always, thanks for listening.